Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box and Clover, working together to provide restaurants with even more technology for a better hospitality experience. Visit getbento.com/better to learn more.
When I was running down my culinary goal, I had hoped to head a New York City kitchen by the time I was 30. It seemed ambitious at the time, and I was equally proud once achieved. But it pales in comparison to the drive and success of today's guest. She can proudly say that she's the owner of 3 restaurants with a 4th on the way, all at that same young age of 30.
Our guest today is Amelie King of the Mala Project. At 23, Amelie opened the first location of Mala Project in the East Village, which Alex and I have had the pleasure of dining at. It's absolutely delicious. Sharing the originality of her hometown Chinese cuisine, and has since opened 2 more locations, one in Bryant Park in New York City and the other in Midtown East, also in New York, with a 4th opening in Greenpoint, Brooklyn in November-ish, which we'll get the scoop on. So welcome to the show. We're excited to chat about your journey so far.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alex and Jenny. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Mala Project for our guests who maybe aren't as familiar with your brand and your restaurants, and you know, where you are today and what you're working on with restaurant number 4.
Sure. Mala Project is a Sichuanese restaurant, and our specialty is something called Mala Dry Pot. Essentially, it's a communal pot, and the customers can design their own pot by choosing different ingredients of their liking, including sliced beef or lamb or chicken. And there's a ton of vegetables like lotus root, bok choy, Chinese cabbage, or some more fun stuff like frog legs or fish cakes, and a lot of tofu pockets and firm tofu like that. And typically, it can be shared by a group of 3 or 4 people, or you can just have a pot by yourself as a quick lunch solution. So we started our first location in the East Village, and we expanded to Midtown West, which is on 46th Street and 6th Avenue. And then last November, we opened our 3rd location on 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue. Finally, we're going to Brooklyn, which is where I live as well. We're going to be in Greenpoint. And unfortunately, our timeline got delayed, as it always does. And the projected opening now is mid-January. But, you know, it's going to be here pretty soon.
Perfect winter food to warm you up in the middle of January.
Yeah.
It's even better timing after the new year too. So this is your 4th location. So you're obviously, there's probably been a lot of lessons learned from 1 to 4. Can you share some of what you've learned, what's changed, all those kind of good things? Share with us your wisdom.
Well, I think when we started our first location, it was definitely, we had no idea what we were doing, and we were so a learning process. And I really, now looking back, I really didn't have time to think long term, or I was just trying to, you know, figure things out as we go in terms of what kind of bricks we need to buy or how does the ventilation work. And on top of hiring and then later on, you know, menu testing. And it actually took us a year to open our first location due to our landmark permit. So But I guess it was a blessing in disguise so that we actually had a whole year to prepare for our very first project. And very, very luckily, we got a warm welcome from our diners and the community was just so supportive. And I think the dry pad itself is such a fun and flavorful dish that, you know, many people can really, they really, really love. So, we did take off, and I think it could have been how young I was and our team was, it could have gone a lot worse, but we were very fortunate to have a successful project. And then as we were expanding, we really, didn't expand as like, we didn't really think about scalability in the sense of running a business. We were just treating each location as its own project. So as we were opening the second one, we made sure the interior design is different from the first one, and so did the third one and our fourth one. So every location, we try to focus on the community and the neighborhood, and that shows up in our interior design or like the floor plan. So I think that was a very it was a good mentality. So we're not in the process of expanding. We're not losing our uniqueness. But yeah.
Emily, you mentioned that the landmark permit process slowed you down on the first opening.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how did you overcome that? Did you just have to wait for permitting, or how did you guys move past that?
Well, I actually didn't know about Landmark and when we signed the lease, and then we realized, it was actually a Landmark building. And it turns out that, you know, it's going to take 4 months for us to be able to start construction. And there was really nothing to do. And so I ended up bartending at a, now it's gone now, but it was called B Flat. A very nice Japanese jazz bar. I was bartending there, and I applied to a couple of jobs to spend my time and meanwhile trying to learn. But I was so naive, and I was just telling everyone that I'm working on my own restaurant. I'm just here for 2 months. I want to learn. And as expected, I didn't get a lot of acceptance except for this bar. It was a very good experience. I was able to spend my time there. But in terms of the restaurant, you know, we were lucky that our landlord was helping us. But besides waiting, there was really nothing you can do. And I think we were kind of going crazy when there is nothing you can do, you just kind of sit there and like thinking, oh my God, what's happening? But luckily we came through.
I appreciate that feedback, because I feel like it does happen a lot where things get delayed, and especially as a first-time restaurateur, I think it's interesting and smart that you kept yourself busy and we're still at work rather than continuing to work on something that really had to just essentially hold.
Yeah, I think it's it's so much worse. You already have a project that's idle and you can't open. You're not meeting the deadline, but also your stress level keeps rising. So it's just important to just try to stay sane and keep a clear head, not get too stressed out about what's. You know, there's about things that's out of your control.
Yep. It's just, yeah, it's always like, try to let go of the stuff you can't control. It's very hard to do, but yeah. Sometimes you just have to remind yourself to do it. It's like great. It's a great mantra. were you able to negotiate rent with the landlord for the landmark status situation, or were you guys having to pay rent that whole time?
We did have to pay. I honestly can't even remember exactly how many months. I think it was 3 months. Back then it was 3 months free, and later on it became 6 months free as the norm. Our landlord is very supportive. However, they're a nonprofit organization, so there's not much they can do in terms of helping us with our rent because it's already pretty low.
I would assume that your second and third locations are not in landmark buildings?
Nope.
Definitely a question to ask at the lease signing. Any other surprises about that first restaurant opening?
Yeah, I think I made a huge mistake in terms of the construction. I hired my contractor was not very responsible. So there was a lot of, you know, going back and fixing things right after we opened. And I definitely chose the cheapest construction team. But other than that, I think like moving forward, I made sure our RGC is very responsible and just a good people. But yeah, I think luckily we didn't have, besides those two things, everything else were actually not too bad.
You mentioned that you approached some aspects of expanding, like you weren't a part of a restaurant group and some like you have. So tell us a little bit about that. How have you like systematized and used your, used your scaling to make things more efficient as you've kept going?
One thing I think I'm pretty nerdy about is the system, and that includes our operation system and our training system. I think I may sometimes carry it too far in terms of too paying too much attention on the details, but I do want to, when we first started, I wanted to make sure, okay, all the chopsticks are put a certain way and we're setting down the menu a certain way. And I think that part of that is because my background from the CIA, and that was all how the fine dining restaurants were training. And us being a fun casual restaurant, you actually don't have to be so anal about those things. But there are certain things that we should keep a good system. For example, our onboarding system, or how do we select our people, our new hire, and what kind of playlists that we create. And honestly, in the past 6 or 7 years of us trying to run 3 restaurants and like keeping our heads above the water, we kind of lost that system from the first location. And now, as we're going to the 4th, we really spent this whole year, and probably it's going to be first couple of months in the next year, put a lot of effort on building this system, the operation system. And so now we're writing our operation manual. And you also have to make sure that it's understandable and easy to use. And that is, I think that's taking a lot of effort, but it's going to be worth it. And I can see once we do have this operation manual, we can even further clean things up and systemize things further. So I think although we're running each restaurant, treating them as like a neighborhood spot, certain things have to be consistent, and it will benefit us from like in the scaling process.
It's always the unsexy stuff that, takes time, but actually makes things better and more efficient. So yeah. I also really appreciate that. And sounds like, so it's interesting the locations you guys have picked out, and obviously in restaurant business, location is it's everything. It's your business. So tell us about your real estate strategy and how you ended up in the spots you did.
Yeah, our first location we were looking at NYU. Although surprisingly, after we opened, we didn't have a lot of customers from NYU. It was actually a lot of just people maybe in their 30s and a lot of New Yorker readers, and that was because of our PR strategy. But later on, we got a lot of young, hip customers, just customers of all age, started coming into East Village as East Village started to also evolve into this more like a mature and a busy area. Our second one, we wanted to be in the office area to target the lunch crowd. And our third one, we also wanted to stay in Midtown, but I liked Midtown East, how it's half residential and half business. And I really like that that street, that particular street that we were on, which is 53rd Street, and I think there's a lot of life there. And with Greenpoint, it's the same thing. A lot of how we choose the location is depending on how much activity that neighborhood has to offer. And we look at our neighboring restaurants and bars, and we look at the residents, are like what kind of people they are, and what, like, how warm that neighborhood is. So with Greenpoint, I think there's, on Manhattan Avenue, there's just so much diversity and so much action. It's really exciting just to hang out there. And moving forward, I think that is what we try to do. Besides the, like, how much activity there is in the neighborhood, we also try to like be in different neighborhoods with different vibes, so to speak. So like some area is residential, some area is more, you know, businessy. Because I think the cuisine itself is such a diverse cuisine. So we try to like kind of have the location to agree on the concept of the cuisine as well.
Are they all roughly the same size, Amelie? And are there one or two shops that are performing better than the others? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, they're all around the same size. Our Greenpoint just happens to be the biggest one, but we try to look at around 2,000 square foot. So they're ranging from 1,800 to 2,400.
And you're doing lunch, dinner. Are you doing delivery to take out as well?
Yep. Yep. Everything.
Everything.
Yep.
Strategic. You're doing everything out of each location. Are there differences you see by neighborhood? Is there like one that's just carried totally by delivery versus, you know, one that's a lunch crowd? How do you like manage that within the portfolio?
Yeah, they are pretty even in terms of the delivery, takeout, dine-in. It's about 50-50. That might change later, but so far they're pretty even. I'm not sure. I would imagine with Greenpoint, I don't know. I think it's hard to say. I would just say like they're pretty even to be safe.
And they're all the same concept. Are you doing anything to systemize the actual food production and the menu between them, or are you operating them all sort of as independent restaurants?
We do. So next step for us is to build our central kitchen so that we can really just systemize our production. But so far, we are controlling our sauce, which is we can make it in batch. So there are 4 core sauces that we put in our dishes, and we batch make those sauces. So that is consistent. Although there is, you know, I just be honest, there's always struggle in terms of like how much sauce this chef is using and how much sauce the same chef next day is using. And it's not like something that you can really control because of the nature of Chinese cuisine. Like they have one wok, one spoon, like one wok spoon, and they really just go by feeling. So it's been really, really challenging to try to systemize our portion and our flavor. So I don't really have a good solution. I talk to my chef about that every single day, and you know, that's something that we just have to keep trying to figure out. They all taste good though. when you're putting two things, like two pots side by side, and you might not have the same exact spicy level, you know? So
it's hard to do that in the same kitchen, let alone across different restaurants.
Yeah, very much so.
How do you control for that? Are you going into each restaurant and taste testing and giving feedback, or do you have like secret shoppers? How are you sort of like normalizing that across the group?
Yeah. So for me, I really had to pick my battle. I think so far I've been focusing on it, like the consistency within each location. So far we've been doing fairly okay with the, like, at least within this one location, you're consistent. And sometimes granted they're, it might change if we have a new chef or something like that. So the chef and I, we just make sure, okay, like at least the food has to taste good, right? It doesn't matter if like a little bit more spicy or a little bit less spicy, it has to taste good. And that's number one. And next step would be to make sure, okay, Monday, Tuesday, like let's try to make things consistent by just really just a chef training. And the next step, which is what hopefully what the central kitchen can solve, is to really bring it to the next level and make sure the measuring system can be implemented somehow. I think I'm not gonna say it's impossible to be done, but I need to know, like, you really do need to pick your battle, because there are 70 different ingredients on a dry pot menu, and each ingredient soaks up flavor differently. Who cares, right? If you have a dry pot, like, who cares if this my tofu packet, it has to be the same spicy level as your sliced beef pot. It's not possible. So within the, I think within our control and the being reasonable, hopefully with the central kitchen, we can achieve some of that.
We talk a lot about like fundraising and how we make things happen on this show. So I'm curious if you're able to share with us a little bit about how you fund your funding, scaling your business, and how that journey's been for you.
Yeah, sure. We put in some money from friends, and my family put some, my partners put some for our first location. It was very, very cheap. We opened with $300,000, and it was a 2,000 square foot space. And then later on, our second location was just funded by our friends who are also our customers and friends of friends who have been to Mala Project and love Mala Project. So that was also a very easy process. And our third one was funded with cash flow, and half of our fourth one is going to be half cash flow and also just from customers and friends. I think
awesome.
For the second one, for the friends and for the customers, did you have customers come to you? Were you going to regulars you saw coming in? How did that, because it's always a question that the chefs or front of house people are asking, of how they turn a good customer into an investor.
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I think for us in particular, we didn't really have to go out and seek. We just reached out to a couple of close friends, and we were able to get the funding together. But there were people that come into the restaurant and they are interested in investing. And I think if you are really serious about fundraising within your customers, I mean, that's a really smart move. We haven't done that ourselves, but I think that's just so intuitive, right? They already love your product and they love your restaurant. I think one way to do it, if we were to like crowdfund, is just to send out an email blast. I haven't done that before. I'm not sure like how much conversion rate that is, but I think that's a pretty good approach. And and I would say like the closing portion is pretty is the key, because a lot of people can get really excited about a concept, and you know they express a lot of interest, but the closing portion might take a month or 2 months, right? And that needs a lot of push for people to actually like, okay, sign the contract and close the deal, to how to not get carried away and not just get discouraged or even maybe a little bit embarrassed about like asking, hey, can you send me my money? Like, we're trying to sign the lease, right? So that needs a little bit like of the skin to be a little bit thicker, but you know, that's, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
That's true. It's very hard to be like, I need the wire in my account now. Thank you.
Yeah.
Never very fun. And I mean, so you opened the first one for $300,000, which is a huge, I mean, that's very hard to do in New York City and especially in the East Village. So kudos to that. And I'm curious if like you use that sort of, it sounds like you've made each one different, but have you had the same sort of budget for each one as you've scaled, or have you, you know, been able to save here and there? How have you budgeted for future projects?
Yeah, we budgeted our second one. We definitely increased the budget, but I realized I had a tendency to under budget and over budget. So with our newer projects, there were times where we realized, oh wow, I was just being too optimistic about like how much money we can open with. So I think even now, it's just so hard to wrap my head around the opening budget. Now, like, you're looking really, you have to look at like $1 million to open a restaurant. And I mean, for our size, that's what seems to be the new reality. And I'm trying to like just try to save money and like try to see how we can do it smarter, cheaper, more efficiently, but also like make sure the quality is good. But it's real. It's definitely real, the price increase. Yeah.
Is that inflationary, or you think just like change over time and just having a realistic budget, or all of the above?
I think inflationary, but also we did start working with, you know, for example, our Greenpoint location, that was our first interior design firm that we actually hired. Previously, we had a really close friend who charged us like $3,000 to help us with interior design, and we never had someone to professionally to help us with that. And then as we are expanding, we realized, okay, now we need to step up our game. And also you make, you know, by having a professional, a really good, trustworthy firm, they just make things so much smoother and easier for us. And we can focus on other things such as, you know, fundraising and expansion. So that's definitely like added on cost. And in terms of our GC team, we do work with a really quality GC team, and everything just adds up really, really quickly. But I think it's important to like still have the frugal mindset. I think if it's a problem that doesn't have, like, money should be the last solution. I feel like if it's something that we can solve, or like solve with a different solution, let's not try to just pay and like go the easy route. But sometimes you have to, again, like pick your battle, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Exciting news for restaurants. Bento Box and Clover have teamed up to provide even more technology for a better hospitality experience.
With over 70% of diners researching restaurants online before they go in person, a strong digital presence is more important than ever.
Bento Box's website, marketing tools, and commerce platform help restaurants get discovered online, make more money, and engage diners in person and virtually.
And Clover's world-class POS and payment system streamlines daily operations for a totally seamless experience.
With Bento Box and Clover working together, restaurants now have an all-in-one solution that makes it easy to deliver better hospitality from the kitchen to tableside and beyond.
Bento Box and Clover,
the right recipe for hospitality.
Visit getbento.com/better to learn more.
That's getbento.com/BETTER.
Cool. Al, you want to move on to...
Sure, let's move on to Order Fire, but just before we do, tell us what's next past. Do you have a roadmap past Greenpoint?
Yeah, we actually are working on our fifth one in the meantime, and we're just looking at locations right now, and so it's been hard to get the space in the location that we really, really want. And meanwhile, I really want to take Mala Project to outside of New York. So as we're building the operation manual and like the system, I want to start thinking about scaling it outside of New York. And that'll be my homework for January. I just did our planning, and it's really, really exciting. And I really feel confident to do that at this point, because I think our team is really mature, and I feel like the market is ready.
Interesting. Hopefully it's somewhere warm for the winter. All right, let's jump into, we usually do an order fires, which is what we call, we do 10 questions in approximately 10 minutes. It doesn't have to be exact, but just sort of quick answer questions.
Okay.
Tell us what your favorite menu item is.
Sliced beef and beef balls, or beef, meatballs.
What's the most ordered menu item?
I think sliced beef and bok choy.
All right, so the sliced beef is a thing to get. That's about a line.
Mm-hmm. Is it your favorite because it's the most ordered, or is it actually just your favorite to eat?
It could be most ordered because I make it all the time. No, it's definitely, it's a great ingredient. It picks up the sauce so well. It's very, very flavorful. A lot of vegetable ingredients. So we have a lot of vegetarian customers, so those are like hot sellers too.
Best food cost item.
Let me think. Chinese cabbage.
Makes sense. What's something that you're doing to make your business more sustainable? It can be, you know, in any sense of the word.
We are actually proud to have like almost close to zero food waste day one. Yeah, because we just use every single part of our inventory. And with the dry pot, the nature of the dry pot, you really can't use. They just get used up, and we get fresh produce every single day. I think 6 days out of the week, so we barely throw anything away.
That's great. How do you, your growing business, how do you plan to hire and keep great employees?
Yeah, great question. We are very, very proud in our retention rate. Our staff, they're just the best people. They come in, they join the team, they rarely, rarely leave. We have people, you know, like since day one, we're a very, very like tight family at Mala Project, and I hope to keep that going. I think it's important to just treat each other as like just like friends, and you really don't have to go so crazy about like I don't know. It's just human to human approach. In terms of hiring, we specifically look for people that we like that have that same energy and same almost like vibration level as we do, and that tend to work out pretty well, and people do get along pretty well once we go through that screening process.
Amazing. So you've had now 4 moments to build. Tell us about your worst building or developing moment, or 4 opportunities, I guess.
I think the most traumatic experience was my first project when the GC, I realized the GC was looking at our drawing upside down.
oh my god.
And I mean, they don't read English, and but like it's a drawing, right?
How far into the project was he looking at upside down? I hope it was early.
Early on. Okay. So luckily I was like, oh, okay. So I called their manager, and he did come in a little bit more frequently, but you know, we made it work.
Oh man. Yeah, oh man.
So many terrible ways.
Yeah.
Tell us your most influential role model, and that can be somebody within hospitality or outside of it.
I think Mark Cuban. I've been watching a lot of Shark Tank.
I love it.
Yeah.
Love Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Amazing. What about your best business resource or advice?
Best business advice?
Or resource, like it could be a book or a website or a podcast or a person, I guess. Anybody that's been, you know, anything that's been helpful to you?
Recently I've been studying a lot about flow, and so FLOW, I think it's, I'm sure many people are familiar with it. It's just a method to stay focused and stay sane. So I try to practice it, and I'm very, very, I almost worship my schedule, which is a concept that is introduced in the flow mentality, like in the flow method. So you have your schedule like set up and you follow it to the T, and it may sound very like boring, but it actually is very, very helpful, and it helps you to stay focused and centered. So I think if anyone's interested, there's a lot of material on flow to look
up. I'm gonna look that up. I need to, I'm like, I need right that
as we speak. One thing you would tell a young hospitality professional about the path to ownership?
I think when it comes to small mom and, or like, you know, individual restaurants or bars, it's not very, very complicated. It's actually pretty simple math. But of course, I can now. I know when I first started, I didn't know that, and it was so easy to get sucked into all these different complications that you have to think about, right? But I think once you figure out your core value, your concept, and your center, and then you kind of, the rest of the picture is about like making sure you're meeting your profit margin, and that's also very simple, just by looking, knowing how much your ingredient costs, and like do the multiples and making sure you are meeting those margins, and then making sure your marketing is effective enough to get the people in. So I would say like it's important to always remember your core concept. And that is not just your branding concept or your food concept, but also like why you're running this business. And that can apply to your hiring concept, right? Your main philosophy. And everything you do need to agree to that core. So if you think about things that way, then it can actually help simplify a lot of things.
That's a great piece of advice. Last one, what is your why? Why did you choose to open a restaurant?
I think there's no place, no job almost happier than being in a restaurant. And there's like people, celebration, food, beverage, alcohol, and laughter. Like it really doesn't get better than that. And you get to talk to people, deal with design, and do food tasting, do cocktail tasting. It's really a rewarding career. It's hard, but it's, I think the hardness doesn't matter when you have all the other awesomeness.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. I agree with that too.
Thank you very much, Emily, for chatting with us. And we wish you all amazing success as you embark on number four and number five. Tell us where we find Mala Project on social and on the web.
Yeah, we are at Mala Project, M-A-L-A Project, on Instagram. Our website is malaproject.nyc. Hopefully that can be changed to malaproject.com soon. follow us on there. And I want to say you guys are just, you know, one of the most amazing brand in the hospitality world. I look up to you guys so, so much, really. I think you definitely shifted the way that people dress, and obviously you're doing a lot more than that. Really, thank you both.
Thank you.
That makes so much sense. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's for sure. That makes us feel so good. Yeah. And we're big fans, so it's mutual.
Thank you.
And we're right down the street from Green Point, so we will be in there frequently.
Awesome.
And you can find us at We Are Opening Soon and at Till It NYC. Thank you again, Emily.
Thank you, both. Have a good day.
Thank you so much. You too.
Opening Soon is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.